Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at the consequences of a line drawn on a map. Since the end of the Cold War, most of the world's conflicts have been a result of divided ethnicities, cultural and religious differences within the boundaries of a nation, especially when the ruling class are a minority within one of those areas. My guest today looks at the long-ranging influence of the diplomatic map makers who drew the lines on the maps after World War I and II, and why simply redrawing the lines today invites further instability and conflict. Janet Bogue is a retired State Department diplomat. She retired as the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, responsible for U.S. Balkans policy. Other assignments during a 24-year career included Nepal, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, and Serbia. She's won numerous diplomatic honors, including for her 1993 dissent on U.S. policy towards Bosnia. She won the American Foreign Service Association's William Rifkin Award for intellectual courage and constructive dissent. And she and a team in Kazakhstan earned the State Department's Award for Valor for efforts to end nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons programs there. Since leaving the State Department, she's been a teacher at Skidmore College and George Washington University. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations late last month when I spoke with her. Janet Bogue, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here. It's a delight to be here.
We're approaching the centennial of the First World War, and you have to look no further than an international newscast to see we're still dealing with the aftereffects of the lines drawn on the maps after that war. From the Middle East to Africa to the Balkans, there were a lot of lines drawn on the map after World War I, and we're still dealing with those effects. And yet, you know, it's been 100 years. We've had another World War since then and a Cold War. Why are these problems all of a sudden manifesting themselves today?
Well, I think my answer to that was that the problems never went away. They were concealed or they weren't the highest priority because of other things that were going on. In the case of Europe and the Middle East, from arrangements that were made at the end of World War I, those issues were largely covered over, in a sense, by the overwhelming situation of World War II and then the post-war Cold War threat of annihilation and the division of the world into various blocks or camps, which tended to keep these kinds of issues from coming up again.
It became conflict was based on political ideology rather than ethnicity or homeland.
And when that went away with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Warsaw Pact and so on, when that kind of bipolar world, in both senses of that term, the geographic and perhaps the mental outlook that we had about the world, I think a lot of these unresolved issues came back, and a boss of mine once said that most of the world's great conflicts were old family quarrels over real estate, if you would have that writ large, the family writ large. And a lot of these quarrels were not settled, and sometimes when they were settled by diplomats and statesmen and generals drawing lines on maps, sometimes just to negotiate their way out of a dilemma, sometimes for convenience, sometimes for spoils for one side or another.
Exploitation, yeah.
And sometimes because they thought they were doing the right thing vis-a-vis the peoples of the Woodrow Wilson sort of self-determination of peoples approach. And the lines often didn't work. And we are living with some of the consequences of that. They sometimes perpetuate a problem. They sometimes create new problems. The lines will often do that. It's enormously tempting to solve problems by drawing lines on maps. It seems neat and clean. It seems fair. It's better than a war. But one has to be incredibly cautious about that approach.
When you look at the maps after World War I, there were two different sort of line drawing exercises, if you will. One, say, in the creation of Yugoslavia, basically trying to help for that self-determination of a people, or multiple peoples actually in Yugoslavia, which that might have been folly right there to begin with. But the other set of lines was basically, well, we're going to take this over and this is going to be ours. Maybe not so much concern for the lines on the map other than to, English appeasing French, French appeasing English, as opposed to the people on the ground.
Well, right, because at the end of a war like that, if you decide that, as the American delegation did, that there were something like 25 nationalities in Europe that deserved their own homeland, that is, a state based on that nationality or identity. Well, where do you get that land? You sure don't take it from the winners of the war. You take it from the losers. And so the map drawing itself becomes a punishment. It becomes a source of friction among these states. And it's not necessarily being done with the best interest or the most accuracy for the peoples involved, because the land that you need to create these states is invariably coming from the losing side.
Right. What about in the case of, say, the Middle East? The English and the French were taking over old Ottoman territory. Basically, they were probably thinking they were going to be there forever. I mean, at that point, nobody's thinking about the end of empire. They were actually thinking of expanding empires.
Right. And it's hard for anyone to look years and years down the road, especially in a conflict situation. Often people will describe something to themselves and to others as a temporary solution. We'll draw this line. We'll sort it out later. And it's unusual for it to be sorted out later. A good example of that is Cyprus, where the ceasefire line has become a de facto demarcation line all these years later, since 1974. Does it mean it will be permanent? Of course not. Nothing in these is permanent. But it has a kind of permanence that was not meant to be when it was first drawn or first accepted. The facts on the ground were accepted as a line, essentially. And I think we see a lot of that kind of thing in the colonial era as well, and in doing things like having European powers divide up what was left of crumbled empires.
You mentioned the example of Cyprus. Is there still a unification movement in Cyprus some 35, 40 years on?
Yes. It comes up routinely and fails routinely. The last time that there was some serious work toward unification was when Cyprus wanted to enter the European Union, and the European Union insisted that there be essentially an effort at this. It failed, and so the European Union accepted part of Cyprus, but not all of it. And again, that tends to solidify the division. Of course, once a piece of it and not the whole thing is involved in other greater institutions.
Well, let's talk about some of the examples that you spoke with the committee about, and that has to do with some of the various, some go back well before World War I, but let's talk with one that was created out of World War I. That was the creation of Yugoslavia and a modern Baltic states. You had Austria-Hungary, plus a couple of independent states like Serbia before World War I. After World War I, the Austro-Hungarian Empire is dissolved. Hungary becomes a separate state. Austria becomes a very small state, and creation of a whole lot of new states. How did diplomats go about creating the Balkans as we know them today?
That's a really interesting study in how they were created. Before the peace conference at Versailles, Woodrow Wilson formed an agency, just went by the name The Inquiry. And The Inquiry was an attempt to bring together people in government and academia, the foremost experts of their day, essentially, on these issues, and sit down. And they really felt, and this is a wonderfully kind of American thing, they felt that the Europeans were all tied up in the past and that the Americans could look at a map objectively, scientifically, and draw the right lines. And so they began collecting data about populations and history and natural barriers and military fortifications. And the idea was that the lines would be drawn based on that, the best science could bring. And for instance, the French had invented overlay maps, which, of course, we do routinely on the computer now, but they were actually physical overlays during World War I to help get better battlefield maps. And that technology was brought in to try to figure out how the map should go. The problem in the Balkans is that it's too complex. In a single village and on a single street, there'll be so much mixture of different ethnic groups, and there was so much intermarriage, and there were so many ethnic groups. And we think today in Bosnia, for instance, of the three main ethnic groups who are so-called Bosniaks, who are Bosnian Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But in addition to that, there are Jews and Vlachs and Roma and Ruthenians and Vlach and some of these ethnic groups that we don't even hear about anymore. And there are also Albanians and Greeks and Macedonians and Bulgarians and Turks and others. So what about those people? And even in a given village, it was almost impossible to do that. On top of that, there was no census data at all for what became Yugoslavia. And so the scientific approach that was meant to be taken turned out to be extremely difficult. And
from some of your maps that you use, it's more pseudoscience.
Right. And so, again, it was an era of some pseudoscience. And one of the delightful things I found looking at the maps made by the inquiry, which are in the National Archives in Maryland now, is that they actually, and I just have a picture of all these young diplomats in a room with colored pencils, coloring in maps madly, trying to delineate the Balkans by height of people, by head circumference. And again, the great pseudoscience of examining the bumps and shapes on people's heads. And then my personal favorite, which is the percentage of blondes. And so they were desperately seeking anything that could show that one group of people lived in one place and one lived in another. And none of that worked. And so in the end, the lines that were drawn were really based much more on big power politics and expediency than they were on what Wilson and his people had hoped would be a completely scientific and rational basis.
What was the weakness of that system that exposed itself in the 1990s, in your opinion? Because you're a specialist on this area.
Well, I think the weakness of that system was that a lot of issues and problems were never addressed. And during the era of Marshal Tito and communism in the former Yugoslavia, the whole thing was held together, but not in a way that was sustainable over the long term.
And you mentioned that all these different ethnic groups, one, it's a polyglot.
Right.
You have intermarriage happening fairly regularly. You would think that these divides would lessen rather than
right.
exacerbate.
Exactly. And in fact, I personally think it's a myth that these were ancient hatreds so intractable that no one could solve them, because people had lived intermingled and side by side for many, many generations. In Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia, about a third of the marriages crossed ethnic lines. And if you really have an intractable hatred, you get the occasional Romeo and Juliet, but you don't get really a third of all marriages being across ethnic lines. So I think that there was a myth of ancient hatreds, essentially, that was useful to politicians in the region. But I think the other thing that happened, and we saw this happening outside the Balkans as well in many other places, was that the communist leaders had to very quickly reinvent themselves in order to hang on to power once communism collapsed or was discredited. And they most typically reinvented themselves as ultranationalists.
And when you think about it, all of a sudden all the divides on political ideologies are gone. So right. What was before political ideology? It was nationalism.
Right. Yeah. So in Serbia, you have Slobodan Milosevic, who had made his way to power as a communist party hack, in a sense, a career communist party official, suddenly becoming the Serbian ultranationalist and riding a kind of wave of demagoguery to power and seeing that as the route to power. And again, you saw it all over in Eastern Europe and the former communist and former Soviet areas.
Was it a matter of all the things that the government has told us we should believe in have failed? And here's a new ideology. I mean, is it just sort of a replacement as you're sort of searching for your place in the world? I mean, capitalism is dog eat dog. It's a very different world. Are they searching for something that is an easy answer?
I think the easy answer part is really important to that, because if your world has just fallen apart, you don't have the job anymore, you don't have the pension, a paid-for apartment, free schooling for your kids, free health care, all the things that the communist world provided, and here is someone who is charismatic and speaks well and is one of your own, or you perceive him as one of your own, and he's saying, it's not your fault, it's their fault.
Sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. My guest today is Janet Bogue, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, a career Foreign Service officer. She's now a visiting scholar at the South Asia Institute at the University of Texas, and she was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on diplomapping, the maps that took place. And let's talk about another set of maps, and that is in the news today, which actually predates World War I, and this is the maps during the colonial British period and the Raj. The British went into Afghanistan in around 1840. They found, like every other foreign power, that it was an inhospitable place for foreigners. And they created a border between then India, which is now Pakistan, and Afghanistan. What are the problems with that border?
Well, if I may, let me just go back and talk about how it was created a little bit, because I think that will shed a little light on what the problems were. And I'm also going to very scrupulously avoid the use of the word border, because it actually has not been accepted by both sides as a border. Ah. I'm going to call it a dividing line, which is a little semantic, but it isn't, according to Afghanistan, it is not an international border in the sense, legal sense of that. But it was agreed in 1893 between Afghanistan and the British Empire. And the background to this was that Great Britain and Russia, this is Tsarist Russia before the Soviet Revolution.
They were playing the great game.
They were playing the great game.
Which is basically spying, basically trying to subvert governments to get gain control.
Right, competing for influence in Central Asia. And the British saw this as a threat to India, which, of course, was the jewel in the crown of empire for them. And so it was, and this was also, I should say, the great age of geography. This was the age when the American geographical societies like National Geographic were formed, as well as the ones in Britain and France. And there was no settled border between India, which was a British possession, and of course, as you rightly pointed out, included present-day Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And so the British decided there needed to be a settled border. They saw this for a number of reasons. One, it would be, they thought, a bulwark against Russia, because they could say to Russia, there's the border. You stop there. Everything beyond that belongs to us. But again, they also just felt uncomfortable having an empire that didn't have a clearly delineated border. Modern states had borders. That was one of the definitions of a state. So off goes Henry Mortimer Durand, a British servant in the colonial service, who had been raised in India. His father was also a also confusingly named Henry Durand, but was a colonial sort of Raj-era leading figure for the British government. And they go off to negotiate with a wonderful man named Amir Abdurrahman Khan, who was the grandson of the man who first sort of united Afghanistan as much as anyone could or had. A kind of Afghan Henry VIII, big and enthusiastic and suspicious and cruel, a huge personality. And Durand went and said, we need to draw a line between your property and ours. And the emir, interestingly, said, no, we don't, because if we draw a line, then I have to defend it. Once there's a border, I have to defend it. So let's not draw one. And in fact, there's a wonderful story, which may or may not be true, that at one point the emir was so frustrated with the British that he asked to see a map of the British Isles. And Durand thought, well, now we're finally getting somewhere. And he pointed, the emir pointed toward Wales and said, what's this? And Durand said, it's Wales. And the emir said, it's not big enough. It's not fair that it's so much smaller than England. Let's make it bigger. And Durand sputtered and said, well, you can't do that. And the emir said, exactly, exactly my point. But the British paid him off, and he accepted this line. It was a huge win for Britain. They thought it would stop Russia, protect India, create a buffer state for them. And it was hailed by Queen Victoria as one of the great steps toward peace. The emir's view, when the British said, now what should we do about the tribes who live where the line is running through, the emir said, let's not tell them. And honestly, that was his solution, that they would only be upset, because in fact, the line ran right through what we might call Pashtunistan, that is, the homeland of the Pashtuns. It ran right down the middle, meaning that this tribe, which had lived there and governed itself for generations, was going to be cut in half by the line. And in fact, the British had never tried to control that part of their empire. They had made deals with the local chiefs. They had paid them off and said, you just govern in your own way. We won't bother you. Our army won't come here. Our police won't come here. Our courts won't come here.
And let me guess, that's probably the tribal lands in Pakistan.
Yes. I was going to say, if that all sounds very familiar, with the Maliks and the chiefs in Pakistan, that's what this area is. And so the British had sovereignty but not control over it. And I know that's a very hard concept for us in America, that you are sovereign over this, but you actually have no control over it. And the emir knew that the Pashtuns would be extremely unhappy about this.
That makes sense why he says don't draw a line.
Right. He said they don't feel that they're Afghan. They don't feel that they're part of the British Empire. They are their own selves. So, in fact, the line was never drawn. The Brits kept sending out little detachments of geographers and soldiers on horseback, and they kept being beaten back by the locals. And, in fact, a very little known fact, the Royal Air Force bombed Waziristan, a name much in the news these days, in the 1920s because the tribes there were rebelling against another attempt to draw the line. So, in fact, that border has never been properly demarcated in the sense of that we would consider a border. And when India became independent and at the same time split into India and Pakistan, Pakistan adopted whole cloth the British agreement. That is, that in the tribal areas along that line, we won't bother you, our police won't go there, our soldiers won't go there, you govern yourselves, we'll leave you alone to do that. And so I'm not meaning to make excuses for Pakistan's behavior here, but when the Pakistanis say to us, we don't have control over that area, we don't actually have any police there, that is a statement of fact, and it's hard for us in the United States to accept or understand, but that is actually true.
Now, you said the great temptation is to fix a problem by drawing lines on a map, and I can just hear people thinking, why not carve out their own homeland? If Pakistan is doing the same thing the British did, it seems like a fairly simple solution. What are the problems in redrawing lines?
Well, they tend to layer on additional problems. But for one thing, it would be very hard to get either Afghanistan or Pakistan to agree to that. It turns out no one likes to give up territory.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
But the other problem is, let's say you do make a little separate state out of Pashtunistan. So the Pashtuns have now their own state. Viable or not is not clear, but let's say they do have their own state. What often happens when these additional lines are drawn is that it unearths problems we didn't even know were there, or the map makers didn't even know they were there. Undoubtedly, there are people there who are not Pashtuns. Undoubtedly, there are others, and there are minorities, and there are other situations that we don't even know about. And I think a great example of this was in East Timor. When East Timor became independent and a line was drawn,
we thought that was going to solve.
And we thought that was going to solve a lot of problems. The next year, there were pitched battles in the street between, and I'm going to say this slowly because it's confusing, the West East Timorese and the East East Timorese. Because one group feels that the other dominates it and it is left out of things. And they then said, if East Timor can be drawn out of Indonesia, then West East Timor can be drawn out of East Timor. It didn't happen. But that's the kind of thing that happens, is that creating what people think of as some sort of ethnically pure or geographically correct state almost never happens. The world is too complicated and varied for that. And I think a much better solution is to create a situation, work toward a situation in which there are rights and human rights and participation and involvement for everyone, rather than trying to draw lines on maps and get ever more pure and distinct areas.
My guest today is Janet Boga. She is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, currently a visiting scholar at the South Asia Institute of the University of Texas at Austin. And she was a guest on the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations speaking about diplomapping. And we were running out of time, but, you know, Africa is sort of the last place anybody from outside of Africa looks for, you know, issues of human rights abuses, conflict. But certainly in Africa today, there are a number of boiling disputes, simmering disputes in Africa. And again, they're based on lines that, for the most part, were drawn after World War I, when Germany's possessions were carved out, and after World War II, when the colonial map becomes post-colonial.
Absolutely right. I would want to add one thing about Africa that's very interesting, and that's when during the early 1960s, in the great period of independence and liberation for Africa, the Organization of African Unity was founded, a consortium of the African states. And the first thing they did was accept the borders, even though they didn't make sense geographically, historically, or ethnically. They only made sense in terms of great power politics. They said, Africa has enough problems. If we start trying to redraw the borders, it will never end and there'll be endless warfare. That's not to say that there haven't been conflicts and border disputes and things like that in Africa, but I think it did save the continent a lot of bloodshed and a lot of grief to simply accept the borders and try to work with them rather than try to start all over again and correct all those mistakes that people perceived had been made.
Are there any egregious borders that are likely to be hot spots for some time to come? I think of like the Congo, Sudan and South Sudan.
Absolutely. In a lot of spots in Africa. And, of course, other issues, Israel, Palestine, that are going to be hot spots that are, again, old family quarrels over real estate. I mean, there are huge issues, not solely about maps and divisions, but these things go on and on. And I can hardly believe that, having traveled up here from Texas today, you know, there's a border dispute between Texas and Oklahoma, happily solved in the courts, not through gunfire. But these are things that, because resources are involved, because pride is involved, because people's identity and history are involved, these are things that are very, very difficult to resolve.
And we should mention, for those who are unaware of the border dispute, it was over water, basically.
A critical resource. Here.
Yeah, whether Oklahoma water can go to Texas without an agreement by the state of Oklahoma and an agreement with the state of Texas to transport that water. And these are likely going to be problems in our country in the 21st century, is demand for resources, especially from about, you know, the start of the West on, because of things like water.
Right. Especially water is going to be a up-and-coming issue in a lot of places about access to resources. And, of course, a huge amount of map problems going back to World War One. A lot of those discussions were, you know, this little piece should actually belong to that country, but that leaves this other country with not a single viable mine, so let's just give them that little corner so they can have a mine of their own and have some resources, even though that means the people living there might have to move and become refugees, or they might have to accept living in someone else's state.
Mm. Well, Janet Bogue, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
This has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Janet Bogue is a retired State Department diplomat and Foreign Service officer who served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia. She was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations late last month, speaking on diplomapping, the maps diplomats draw and their consequences. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.